And then for sure, the fact that there was the school there. And in a small town like that, your school is also the social center of the village. And there were, so much of my time was taken with the fact that I was the only teacher in a one-room school, plus being a member of the community. So it's always been a very full year, every year.
What sort of things would the school be used for?
Essentially a community hall. It substitutes for a community hall. If especially in Hot Springs, where you have the lodge closing in the wintertime. So any fundraising activities that, well, sometimes we would also hold them in our home because our home happened to be the largest one in town. In later years, the hangar was used for some activities. But also the weekly movies, the school has also been the center for that. Also, when you had an activity like a spelling bee, in the years when we used to, our children used to participate in activities of that type, the people in the community, we raised money for that rather than, because there weren't travel funds in the school budget for that type of thing.
I was wondering about some other changes you might have experienced when you first moved to Manly, for instance. Things you might have done that you never did before. Hunting, maybe? Or maybe you did do them before.
No, I've never hunted, nor has my husband is not a hunter either. In the 20 years that we were in the 23 years that we've been there, he shot one moose, and I think he's sorry he even did that. he would prefer to shoot with a camera. He's not a hunter, nor is my husband a trapper. And I do love going out on, like I used to love to go out on snowshoeing, or going out into the woods. Usually if I do something like that, it's the property itself has a lot. You can roam on the property since it's 278 acres and there's a lot to see. But if I did go out hiking, I usually did it with some purpose in mind. But there was Mary Clements, who was quite an artist. There were some things that we had in common in that area, and the Diamond Willow was one of them. And because I've done some carving with the Diamond Willow. And so we would spend hours hiking, just looking for Diamond Willow. And in the fall, berry picking time is very much of a ritual with me. I feel like I've really been denied something each year if I don't get out at berry picking time. And Mary and I used to have our little private hidden patches that we never told anybody about down the slough, you know, and black currants, which aren't in that great a supply there anyway. We would take her canoe, her little boat, and when you plan on activities like that, you plan on being gone, you know, all day. And that used to be an annual type thing. And Barbara Strandberg, who comes there every summer, is also someone that I like to spend time with each year. She and I go out berry picking. It's more also than just berry picking, you know. You're doing something very useful, but it's something that you also enjoy very much. And so I like to spend that time with people who I know enjoy it as much as I do, and I know for sure she does.
I'm not sure if I heard it right or remember right, but it seems there was some story about you having a run-in with a bear. Is that true?
And that was, did you want me to tell that story now?
Yeah.
Because the first time I told it, you know, I could tell it in about 3 minutes. Now it takes me about 45. Somebody asked me how big that bear was. And I said, oh, it must have been at least as big as an elephant. But it also happened, this was in the summer of 63, when we just had any number of experiences with bears. There were a lot of them there. And a lot of things, strange things were happening. And it still is a point of curiosity with me, because I don't know what would have caused them to behave the way they did. And I've never heard of any explanation for it, because there were a lot of berries that year. It was...
They
just did not scare away like they do, you know, the noises. Like, you make certain noises, tin cans and all that kind of stuff, and it's supposed to scare them away, and dogs are supposed to be able to scare them away. And instead of being scared by them, they would turn around and attack instead. And if my memory serves me correct, within a mile and a half radius of our town, they killed, it was either 26 or 29 bears that summer, and at least that many in the outlying mines and woods, you know, out of town. But on that particular day, we had had this bear up around the greenhouse, and I had asked... Chuck and the two boys happened to be in Fairbanks at the time, and Diane and I were at home, so I asked Bill Burke, who was working on the road, to show me how to shoot Chuck's 300 Savage, because I had shot it before, but it had been so many years that I didn't know how to handle it. And then he said he would be there to help me after work that evening. But then I recalled after he left that, after I'd made the arrangement with him, that Lee Gardner, who was suffering from muscular dystrophy and lived on that houseboat, that he had asked Diane and me to go down the slough with him and be his legs to show him how this blueberry patch was. And we had promised him we'd do that. So when Bill Burke came, I said, I don't have time to go out and shoot the gun with you, but just tell me how to load it and unload it, which he did, and that was it. So the next day, I went up to pick strawberries, which were just beautiful that summer in abundance. We've never had our wild strawberries that good since or before. That was the one good year. And they were on the slope right behind the greenhouse. Barbara and her son, who were the only ones that lived at our end of town, had gone out to the mine to do some painting. So essentially it was Diane and I alone at the house, except Lita Roberts had come to visit her that day. So they were playing at the house, and I went off to pick berries alone. And the slope is a steep one right behind the greenhouse, and I was about 10 feet from the slope, from the edge of the slope. And all of a sudden I had this feeling like you have, that someone is close by, and I stopped picking and tensed, and I turned around, and right at that edge of that slope, less than 10 feet from me, I don't know if I smelled him or what, was that bear. And all I remember was saying, all right, if you yell at them or hit a metal can, they'll go away. And so I pounded against this coffee can that I was picking the berries in and yelled at the top of my voice. Afterwards, I realized instead of screaming like a lady should, when I screamed, it came out in one hoarse voice. You know, it was and that's all I remember doing. And the bear just stood and stared at me. It didn't move at all as I was doing this. And so I panicked, And there was a birch tree that was probably about 20 feet in the opposite direction, one beautiful large birch tree standing all by itself. And all I could think of was, I can run faster than that bear around that tree, and that going around that tree will slow him up, and then I'll make a dash for the greenhouse. And not remembering that Chuck had said, if a bear chases you, run downhill, because they can't run downhill as fast as you can. And as I started running toward the tree, I looked back and he was running after me. And all I could think of was just, I have to go, you know, keep going. And so I started for the greenhouse, and that was just almost level ground there. But then, of course, when then there was the steep slope again. And so I was running as fast as I could then. And of course, when I hit that slope, it's kind of rocky, and it's I hit a soft spot and I tumbled, and the berries went into the air. And all I could see as I went down were these little red dots in floating around in the air all around me. And my glasses flew off and broke. And as I started to rise, I looked up, and there was the bear sitting on its haunches on the edge of the slope. So I dashed for the greenhouse to try to calm myself a little. And of course, I went way inside the greenhouse. And so when I came to the door, I didn't see the bear. And I looked all around, and I couldn't see him, so then I ran for the house. And when I got to the house, by the time I got there, and I told the girls that the bear had chased me, all I could think of was those berries, and he had, you know, I lost about 2 quarts of real nice strawberries, and I got mad. And I told the girls we're going to go right back up there and just get some more berries, and I'll take the gun up there and I'll just kill it if I see it. So we went right back up, but the bear never showed up. And that night, Diane and I, it started to rain heavily that afternoon then. It was one of those summer, typically hard rains that you have on a hot summer afternoon. And so nobody came up. It was too wet. And Diane and I went down to the bath, and we came back up to the house, and Diane was telling me a creative story that she had thought of, and we were sitting there in robes and wet hair, and I was listening to her story, and all of a sudden we both stopped. And we turned around, and there was the bear in our front yard. And we had a dog, a Malamute, and the bear went for the dog, but the dog was a big one, and he and the bear took off into the woods right across our yard. So I grabbed the gun, and we went out. We saw it going down the hill toward the bathhouse, and went right up the steep slope towards Strandberg. So I said, "We're going to get it." And we walked up the road towards Strandberg's and turned around, and there was that, Diane said, "There he is, he's on his haunches." And not even thinking, I suppose I start to panic again, not even thinking, all I did was go at that bear. I just took up my gun and just shot him, you know, and I didn't even aim, you know, it was just ridiculous. And of course, here we were on a wind or a rainy day, and in robes and slippers and wet hair, and here I'm jumping 6 inches off the ground with a rifle at my hip, aiming at a bear, you know, just utterly stupid. And Diane said she just looked at me, and I looked so funny she couldn't help but laugh. And she started to laugh, and I said, the bear just spun around and took off. So then we went down Strandberg's, and I said, "Well, Diane, if something happens and that bear comes toward us, let's just run into the bathhouse and just close the door." And we went down, and we did have a greenhouse right across the road from the bathhouse then. So we got to the edge of that greenhouse, and we saw the bear going across the valley where the Karshner Creek runs. And then I had the sense to go ahead and take aim at that bear. And I took aim, I shot, and he was probably 300-400 feet away. Shot, and I said, "Oh, Diane, I missed it by a mile." It just took off across the creek into some ferns that were probably about 4 or 5 feet high. And so we went back up to the house. Well, then Linda Roberts' dad, Horace, came up to the house that evening after 9:30. He said he would have come up sooner, but he wanted to listen to Tundra Topics first. And he said, "Would you show me where you shot that bear, or shot at the bear?" And I said, "Oh, Horace, it's raining so much out there, you're just going to get soaking wet." He said, "Oh, that's all right." He said, "I'd like to see it." I said, "Well, okay, if you're willing, I'll be glad to show it to you." So I went out and showed him, and of course all you saw were the ferns all lying flat from the heavy rain. And I said, "It was right there, but I know I missed it by a mile." And didn't think anything more of it. And the next, about 3 days later, Horace stopped at the house, and bless his heart, he had gone up to that spot where I had first seen the bear. He went up there every morning and every evening and waited for the bear. And he said, "You know, I think you got that bear." And because I've been up there every morning and every evening, and the bear hasn't come back. And he said, "That bear would have been back." He said, "I think you heard it." And then I felt just horrible, because I just had visions of this wounded bear. So then we got serious. And the ladies in town got together and we all went out to the gravel pit and did some serious target shooting. And by that time, I had this terrible feeling. I had that bear so much on my mind that when I go up to the greenhouse and work up there, close it, I'd carry my gun with me. And but I was sick. All the shadows were becoming bears, you know, and I knew that I should straighten my line of thinking, but I couldn't help it. I was, I suppose, those moments of panic had greater control than reasonable thinking, and. When I'd go to turn the light plant off at night, I'd ask Diane to come with me and make her talk all the way down there so I'd be sure not to. And finally it got so when I'd go around the corner of a house, I'd look first to be sure that a bear wouldn't be coming around the corner. And but our shooting was better and I felt more comfortable about that anyway. And about a week, by this time, a week passed, and this by this time the boys had come back home, and they were up at Strandberg's playing with Steve, who was their age, and I was having trouble with the pipes that were running to the bathhouse. The heavy rains had broken them apart, and I had to find where they had broken. So I had taken off my shoes and I was walking up the creek checking each joint to see where the break was. And I bent over in the creek and started to look, and I glanced sideways into the ferns. Probably the bear was on my mind again. And I saw this black shadow again. And I thought, oh my God. You know, and I just dropped the pipes and I ran up to Strandberg's and I said, all I could say was, come and see what I see. And they said, what are you talking about? I said, I can't wait. Come and see what I see. And they came with me, and of course the boys were, I yelled where it was, and the boys ran on ahead and they jumped across the creek and looked and spread the ferns apart, and there was the bear. I had got it with that one shot. And he had died, crossed the creek and got gone just about 10 feet into those ferns. And then the ferns essentially hid him from view. And of course, when we spread those ferns, it had been hot, and the rain, between the hot summer days, and it was really hot, and the rain that we had, it was just a horrible stench. And we just decided we have to bury him right then. And Arnold Grice and his wife happened to come up for a bath just about that time, and Arnold did his neighborly duty by coming and helping us dig the hole. And Jim wanted to put a white cross there as a monument for the bear. And I'm sorry he didn't do that, because we'd know exactly where he was buried today. And that's my bear story. Actually, it was a week later than that Bill Strandberg was killed at the mine over the hill in Tofty. And I know if it would have been the other way around, and if I would have met that bear a week after instead of a week before Bill's tragedy, that I would have died of a heart attack right there.
You see, attacked by a bear?
Uh-huh, and killed, and it was a horrible situation because he was at the mine alone, and the bear was—he had partially eaten him by the time he was found. But that the combination of that experience and Bill's, and a couple of others in town, just so totally changed my opinion about bears. I have no feeling at all, but a good one, when somebody says that they've shot a bear. I can't help feeling that way now. Because all of that summer I had these horrible nightmares, because Chuck was working construction and I was alone at the house with the three children. And after that, we had bears come between Barbara's house and mine, and of course she was home alone with her son too. And when we would visit each other, we would carry guns. And there were a couple of incidents where the children had run from one house to the other, and it was just coincidence that the bear wasn't in between them when they were, you know, just where they saw the bear after they got into the house. The bear could easily have been within sight. And it just got to be a really bad summer. And I'd have these nightmares, and that was the fall that we moved into Fairbanks, because the children were junior high age. And one night, the first week where we were in Fairbanks, we were living in a house close to the tracks in the college area, and it was dark, and I was going to visit a friend in college, the three children and I. And I stepped out of the house, and it was dark outside, and all of a sudden something recreated the smell of that bear. And this, and I don't know, I can't explain why it happened, because I hadn't been consciously thinking of it, nor heard anything in the news or on the radio or talked to anybody about the bear. But I walked out that door, it was dark. Maybe the fact that it was dark, and there was this odor that overwhelmed me, and it was the smell of that bear. And I had this panicky feeling, and I had to just go back inside and just relax and take hold of myself. And then I went back out, and I was all right. And it was just that type of feeling. It was a horrible feeling that stayed with me all that summer. And it was for a few years after that, I could force myself to go and pick berries in that place, but I would be very uncomfortable all of the time I was up there. And it was about 2 summers ago, we had a garden right at the bottom of that slope, and Liza and I were working in the garden. And we have trained all of the dogs not to come up to the greenhouse because of the damage that they can do in the gardens. And we were in the garden, and all of a sudden we heard this noise in the bush, like an animal crashing through underbrush. And here it had been about 13 years since the bear incident. And I heard that crashing in the underbrush, and I had a hoe in my hand, and I threw that hoe down, and I ran about 50 feet before I realized what I had done, you know, that I had panicked over a 13-year-old memory. And I stopped, and I said, what am I doing? And we just stood there. And in a little while, here comes Slug, Liza's dog, out of the woods. Slug had been trained not to come up to the greenhouse, so she had walked all around and came through the woods in the back to see Liza.
Well, when you had seen the bear from inside the house, when you were with Diane, that was, you saw it through the...
through the plastic, house. Right.
Boy, that wouldn't make you comfortable either way.
No, and that's probably the fact that the bear came right into the yard, and the fact that we had those plastic walls, and knowing that the claws of a bear could tear those, probably increased my anxiety about the bears, especially at night with the small, with the children. Well, we had other incidents with bears, you know, a few of them at the house. I'll let Chuck tell you about those. And, you know, bears coming into the house even.
Coming into your house?
Mm-hmm.
Did they use the door?
Well, did Chuck never mention that story. Well, he tells it better than I do. So.
We didn't really get into, we got up to, what, 1956?
Well, it was the very first years we were there. You know, when we lived in the old house at the bottom of the hill, the log cabin. And of course, the fact that nobody had lived there for several years also probably made a difference. But we had a couple of incidents with the bears there. But strangely, I didn't have the reaction from that one, but it didn't also involve me as directly as that it was the fact that that bear chased me. You know, I was being attacked by that bear. And I've had people tell me, well, you made your mistake in running away from it. You should have run toward it. I am sure that if I would have gone, made up the difference between that 10 feet initially between the bear and I, that he wouldn't have been about to turn around and run away from me. Not the way bears acted that summer.
That sounds like a very strange summer.
Mm-hmm.
Because I've been around a lot of bears. Just never any experience like that.
Uh-huh.
You might tell me different things if you had experience like that.
Huh? Yeah, right. I would for sure. Don't miss the hair, she can make these. Well, perhaps we should just talk about education a little bit, seeing as that's been your career. We've only missed about 20 years so far. Did you have some questions that you thought of?
Well, in the fall of 1958, do you want me to tell you about the initial school experience there?
Yeah.
Okay, I had taught just the 1 year in the college area, and then we moved to Hot Springs. And then in 58, we did have 10 children. And we found out that with a school enrollment of 10 children, and a certificated teacher in the village, and a building, we could establish a special school. And we began this process early that summer. And school was going to begin in September. So we found out that they would accept that little log cabin. It's the 16 by 20 cabin on our property, right next to the bath. And I was certificated, and the State Board of Education approved of it. And afterwards, I was told that it was also with the help of Dr. Ryan, who was the commissioner at that time, and he was the superintendent of the Fairbanks schools the year that I taught in Fairbanks. And it was at his recommendation, because he remembered, I remembered meeting him and talking with him the year that I taught in the Fairbanks area. So we were all set to go, except for the fact that there were no supplies. And the first day of school opened, and then they asked me what was I going to do, since there were no books and there were absolutely no supplies. And Chuck had fixed up the building, and he had two large tables there, one high enough for the older children, and one he cut the legs down for the smaller children, and then got the Blazo boxes, which we used so much of, which we collected over the years, and used the Blazo boxes for their chairs, and collected all of the pencils and paper that we could in town. We always had a lot of books around, and so I had some books at home that would help me, but I had to open school, and then we also took a 4x8 ply board and painted it with black slate paint, and that was our chalkboard, and we were ready for school. And the chairs came, or the children's desk came the end of September. And this elderly gentleman, Ed Lawler, who was a special favorite of everybody's, and he was certainly a special favorite of mine, came up, and he assembled the desks and the chairs, but I still didn't have any supplies. So what I was doing with the 10 children, I was keeping, I had to construct their daily schedule and supplies from practically a day or mail day basis, waiting for the books to arrive. And thinking they'd be there imminently, and they still didn't show up after the month was over with. Then fortunately, Elizabeth Murrow, who was superintendent of schools at Ladd Field, came to visit on a short trip to Hot Springs. And she found out what our situation was, that we were still waiting for our books and supplies. So she sent some emergency supplies from her school at Ladd Field. And on Halloween, we received our books and our supplies. So for the first 2 months, I taught with using any ingenuity on hand to keep the children going. And it was quite a challenge for the first year out in the village, and my second year of teaching. But I knew if I could handle those first 2 months with anything that I could dig up around town, that anything from there on would be a lot easier, and it certainly was.
That was your first winter in Mammoth?
No, that was in 1958. So I came down with the children in the spring of 56, so We were there for 2 winters, and the school was established the 3rd winter we were there.
Were you teaching your own children prior to that?
I taught, yes, I taught Diane, and the state provided correspondence courses through Calvert's for elementary students, and she started her first year in October, and she was through in February, and they told me I could start her right in on the next into second grade right away. But I was concerned about the speed at which she was going through with that. And I thought if she gets into a public school system, she'll fall into that same situation that I had, where I was accelerated as a child. And then I was told on certain occasions I was too young to do this, you know, where other children my age or my academic age were doing, that I didn't want her to be put into that same position. So I tried to supplement during that period so she would run on a normal class age in the state.
So what would your typical school day be like in those first 2 months?
Well, it was very hectic because I felt so frustrated by the lack of supplies. But it also taught me a lesson well, that you do, you get the most out of what you have. And there was a lot of creative type of material. Of course, a lot of it had to do with the fact that I had no knowledge what the state used for their texts. I had none of that information to go on. But I just went ahead and did my own thing as far as learning, teaching, of course, teaching the children, the smaller children, how to begin writing, and with the older children, letting them do their own writing. And I use pretty much local inspiration for themes of that type, simply because that was the thing that they could go to as their resource. You know, I can remember thinking about descriptions of the area. The hot springs itself was quite valuable that way.
That school building was heated by the hot springs?
Mm-hmm. The arrangement that Chuck had with them was he would supply the building, the heat, the light, and janitorial services for $100 a month. So the school in Hot Springs to teach 10 students cost the state $100 a month. And we did light with the Coleman lanterns in those days because we didn't have our light plant. Then when we received the light plant, Chuck bought the light plant. Then he increased the contract price with the state to $150 a month. And that included the school, the heat, electricity, and janitorial services.
How would that compare to a school today?